Apollo's Bow Audio presents Horses, a story by Vincent Pinella. Read for you by Vincent Pinella.
In the mid-70s, I lived in an old farmhouse in Oxford, Iowa. My landlord was ready to retire, and his name was Perry Burns. He had a 200-acre farm where he grew corn and beans and at one time kept hogs and cattle. This story is based on the year that Perry had bad luck with his corn crop. It's called Horses. The character McCabe is based on Perry. The other characters are drawn from the farm people I knew then. Horses. The pickup seemed not to approach, but keep its distance as it rose and fell, disappearing into valleys, reappearing on hilltops, and then sinking into a last long depression where it acquired sound, the fan belt chirping, the engine roaring. Then it rose up full size, heading toward him and bearing down. McCabe had been standing at his mailbox. He stepped into the road and signaled, not giving ground when the truck skidded on the gravel and halted just inches away. Here is a 10-acre fool, he thought, a man with a new truck he didn't need, four-wheel drive and nowhere to climb, a fancy stock rack but nothing to haul. Eldon rolled down the window and looked past his uncle to his two horses ripping up grass along the road as if each bite would be their last. As McCabe began to speak, Eldon looked down at his boots on the brake and clutch pedals. He didn't want to listen to his uncle, whose slow and definite sentences had been carefully planned to corner him. Dog running my cattle, loose horses right here, stud horse in my fields, feed costs money. If the uncle had any sense of family, he would have invited the nephew's horses and anything else on four legs to winter in fields wall to wall with fallen corn. Even with horses and cattle feeding there all winter, plenty of corn still lay on the ground. It wouldn't be eaten. It would be plowed under and return as volunteer to ruin next year's beans. If anything, the stud horse was doing the uncle a favor. But the man only understood fences, so Eldon would talk fences. A man's got four fences, he said, then toyed with his gear shift as if he were already down the road. Eldon continued, he's got four fences, but he's not responsible for all four, because his neighbors is responsible for some. Now maybe these horses right here, and he paused to gesture, specifically excluding the stud horse in the uncle's field, out of sight at the moment, maybe these horses got out another fence, a south fence or an east fence. I checked your other fences, McCabe said. Eldon exhaled wearily and looked up the road. He wanted to be on that road with a wake of dust behind him. Now, Uncle, I can't say you ain't checked them. I'm just saying there's no proof these horses got out my side. They could have got out another side and come over here that way. Then I'd say we both got a case against somebody else. The conversation ended with nothing resolved. McCabe returned to the house with his mail. Talking was a mistake. Eldon was the same prideless liar he'd always been. There'd been no growing up, no learning of lessons, even after making a bad job of trying to farm the 80 acres his father left him. McCabe was embarrassed for his dead brother's sake, but there was nothing he could do. The family was finished in this part of the country anyhow. He was retiring and moving south in a year because his daughters wanted no part of farming. Eldon would sell out if only because a man couldn't hold on with just 80 acres. Behind his house, McCabe looked over his field. The cattle were off on the high ground. The sun was melting the ice crust, and mist rose from the earth, black from thaw. He'd seen that earth bone dry and the color of ashes, too. He'd seen that earth wear any number of colors, and soon he would sell it to a doctor or lawyer who would use it as a tax write-off. He and his wife would reduce themselves to one car, a few suitcases, and an ice chest, and they would start a life in a place where he would never shovel snow. Goodbye to this farm he'd plowed with horses and plowed with tractors, to the hills he'd flattened and valleys he'd filled in as he moved the earth every season. One more bean crop, and they were gone. But last year or not, he was still a farmer and had to watch his fences. Before entering the house, he looked toward the road where Eldon had tied his two horses on a neighbor's fence with promises to retrieve them later. They were tearing at grass with that blind appetite which came to animals after a winter of dry feed. They'd run up on his lawn that morning and put holes in the ground. They'd been there before, too. Two loose on the road and a third in his fields all winter. Last and most important, the dog harassing his calves and cattle. Over the years, neighbors had shot or poisoned Eldon's dogs, penned up his stray stock, even stole it for damages. But he still refused to take care of his own. He'd spoken to Eldon that morning for family's sake. Now that obligation was over. When McCabe entered the kitchen, his wife was placing a frozen chicken in a rectangle of sunlight on the kitchen counter. He called her Grandma. Without looking at him, she said something which had become not a statement of fact, but a shared emotion because it reflected on the family. "He don't need a truck like that if he'd own farm," she said. McCabe waved disgustedly and said, "Damn fool won't mind his horses either." "He's no fool," she said. "We've been feeding them." McCabe spent part of the day reading the farm journals and listening to the market reports. Beef, pork, corn, soybeans, all higher than he'd ever known. He'd spent a lifetime growing meat and grain and made enough money to keep his 280 acres out of the bank until last year, when heavy rains rotted the stalks of his corn, which fell too low for the picker. He'd lost at least 200 acres of good corn. He'd almost missed his chance to get it back, too. And even if he'd seen that chance, he might not have taken it. Caution and respect for nature were built into him. As his father's gift, the farm carried the constraint of caution, so he planned to do nothing about last year's loss except deduct it from taxes. But then Jack Wagner came along. Wagner was a bachelor who lived with his mother and who not only farmed his 120 acres, but also ran a truck and tractor repair shop from his barn. He was slow, smart, and deliberate. But he had a peculiar habit, and this had worked in McCabe's favor, a weakness for horses. Like Eldon, Wagner kept horses just to keep them, never riding them and hardly having time to enjoy the sight of them. They weren't quarter horses or fancy draft animals or even smart carriage horses which could be sold to the Amish. They were like Eldon's horses, the sale barn dregs, 40-odd, now wintering on McCabe's fallen corn along with the cattle. Last fall, Wagner swung into McCabe's in his Sunday car, a Thunderbird bought for practically nothing because of a broken transmission. He sat in the kitchen with his hat on, going only so far as folding up the ear flaps. Removing it would be embarrassing, for at 36, only the area around his ears showed hair, and this as gray as old snow. He nursed a cup of coffee, smoked a cigar with a plastic tip, and approached his business sequentially, ascertaining what was already apparent to anyone driving by, that McCabe's acres were littered with good corn, that such ears would fatten anything the fences could hold, that the ditches which creased the fields were filled year-round with clean runoff, and that, if a fella put some stock cows out there, and if it didn't snow too bad, he might feed him until spring for nothing. "But those ditches'll freeze," said McCabe. "Cattle need water to stay alive." Wagner considered this in the quiet, sun-flooded kitchen as he puffed the cigar back to life, then tapped it on the ashtray. "Not if a fella had horses," he said. And McCabe got the picture then, Wagner's horses and his cattle. He waited for Wagner to continue. "Horses break the ice with their feet. Horses is different than cattle," Wagner said. That day he and Wagner trudged across the cornfield in their rubber boots, crushing the frozen mud crust and sinking into the ground with its treasure of bright yellow ears. "Damn shame," McCabe said, still not letting on that he had already pictured it. The horses breaking the ice so his cattle could drink. "A damn shame," he repeated, kicking at a tangle of ears and stubble. "But that's the way it is sometimes. There's good years and there's bad years. I'd say, overall, we're about even," McCabe said. "This is good feed," Wagner said. "But I got nothing to give it to," said McCabe. "Come spring, this corn will still be here, and you'll have one hell of a mess in your beans. You'll have half corn and half beans, and nobody'll buy the stuff." "I know that," McCabe said. "How's your fences?" Wagner asked. "Good enough if there's feed inside." "I could put my horses here," he said, "but 40 or so head won't begin to eat all this." They agreed on a price for wintering the horses. Then McCabe went to his wife and told her what he wanted to do. "Cattle's always been our worst," Grandma said. We made money over the years on hogs, but you figure up all the years we had cattle, and I'd say we're behind. You saying we shouldn't do it? I ain't saying that. I'm just saying what happened over the years. You could stop me now, McCabe said. We don't have the years to make up the loss. You know your luck with cattle, she said. Yes, but when we made money on cattle, it was big money. I ain't saying nothing, she said. They worried it for several days. They prayed over it in church. McCabe took long rides to see what other farmers were doing. I think cattle's scarce, he said. I just don't see so many. We can lose again what we lost on the corn, she said, and we won't ever make it up. McCabe said, there's feed out there for at least 200 head of stock cows. If they're bred, we've got 400 by spring, and they'll get water because horses keep the ditches open. You got hay to feed when it snows? She asked. It won't snow bad, he said. I heard that before, she said. Her strongest argument was the weather. If snow covered the corn, he would need hay, and he didn't have a bale. Men selling hay in winter would charge him right out of his boots. It just won't snow bad, he repeated, as if he knew what he was talking about. He believed his words, only because the previous winter had been bad. Her last words were, I can't stop you, the words she used when he made up his mind. In fact, she could have stopped him, but didn't want to. Nor could the bank refuse a man with 280 paid-up acres and a lifetime on the same farm. They advanced the money cordially, and McCabe went to livestock auctions and picked out every animal. His word for them was gummers, old cows with worn teeth, sold cheap because they didn't have many breeding seasons left. There were Angus, Hereford, Charolais, all old and good at foraging. They'd been pregnancy tested, and their stomachs swelled as much from permanent expansion of their rib cages as from the calves they carried. McCabe put $60,000 worth of cattle into the fields within 2 weeks of receiving the money. And when they were finally there, nudging and nibbling at the corn ears and pulling the stalks from the mud, he and his wife went to Mass and prayed. Then there wasn't much to do but wait. There were small chores like checking fences, putting out salt and mineral blocks, and occasionally counting heads. Much of McCabe's winter was spent with a basement full of junk and antiques, which he'd collected over the years when the soil bank plan paid him not to farm. What wasn't thrown away was reorganized for his own farm sale, which would take place after the soybean crop was in. They would sell everything except the Chevrolet, and thus end 100-odd years of McCabe's in Iowa, except for Eldon. A good auctioneer was already lined up, and most of their worldly goods would be listed on a printed bill posted in stores and taverns. As we are no longer farming, we will sell. Now, in spring, to the list of chores, he added the rousting of Eldon's horses and dog. Heavy horses could do plenty of damage to a soft lawn, and later to their garden. On the horses he used a shotgun, at long enough range to sting, no more. For the loose horse in the fields, a small stallion, he could do nothing. It was too wild to get near. He hadn't shot at the dog yet, but the day was coming. It was learning to bother the cattle, and the next step for a stray dog like that was to kill calves. On the day he spoke to Eldon about the loose animals, the dog came sniffing around the house, looking for a place to lift its leg. It chose the side of the house, then approached McCabe, shamelessly wagging its hind end. McCabe attacked it with a rake, pulling the tines over its back. The dog turned tail, bellied under the barbed wire fence, then scampered into the field. Some cows with calves at side turned protectively, lowering their heads and blowing steam while the dog ran a circle around one, then another, moving out of range when a charge was threatened. McCabe cursed. Old cows couldn't stand that kind of harassment. Given time, not only would a calf be killed, but other dogs would come, and a whole pack would have to be destroyed instead of just one. One morning the McCabes watched from their window as Eldon came up the drive on a Palomino mare, a rope coiled around his shoulder, a baseball cap pulled low over his eyes. Part of his saddle was worn to the wood. The bridle reins were made of clothesline. Just look at that, said Grandma. Arrogant as hell, McCabe said. He's here for his horse, said Grandma. He got it fat for free, and now he's here to get it, probably because he's been shamed into it. She rolled a filter cigarette in her Laredo machine, lit it, and watched Eldon open their gate and ride into their field, easy as you please. She pulled up a chair and sat, holding the cigarette near her ear as if listening to it. McCabe said, "My brother owned 120 acres, and he sold me 40 because he knew his son wouldn't do much. He was right. He ain't done a thing but fool with horses that ain't even broke to ride."
"He won't get that stud out of there," Grandma said.
"The damn thing's wild," said McCabe.
"Maybe his dog can help him," said Grandma. "I wonder where his dog is."
"You know, Grandma," McCabe said, "there's one way to take care of that dog." She watched while he finished his thought, leaning forward and swinging an imaginary rifle to follow a moving target, a piece of hyperbole he'd learned as a boy when he was more interested in rabbits and pheasants.
"You think a fella'd ask permission before he came on our property," she said. "But I guess if he don't ask permission for his horses, he don't need it for himself neither."
Eldon rode east, passing the original McCabe house, an unoccupied, paint-peeled clapboard affair more than a century old. The house was a trio of salt boxes built onto each other as the family grew. Eldon had never lived there, but his father and uncle had, in the days of horses and hired hands. His uncle had ruined the place, renting it to lowlifes until there was too much damage to fix. Now it was a hotel for rats and raccoons. For an ambitious man, the house was still worth tearing down for salvage, but when he offered to do this, McCabe refused him. South of the house stood a tornado-blown barn, one side torn off and exposed to the weather, its second floor sagging from its burden of rotting hay. Built onto the barn at ground level were two large stock pens made with heavy timbers, also beginning to rot because his uncle was too lazy to salvage the timbers and siding. As he rode, he saw how much corn the rain had damaged. Rows of cobs, nearly parallel, protruded from the mud, fallen too low for the picker. The cattle showed the effects of this rich feed. Cow bellies glowed like patent leather. Calves had thick, velvety coats. The more corn he saw, the more his uncle's lack of generosity irked him. Corn was money, but only if it could be harvested. Eldon pushed the mare into a canter, feeling her sink with every step. He called her Zipper, a smart horse, the first to break a fence, the first to return when he whistled her home. The next morning, after his uncle had complained, he noticed marks on her back and legs, which at first he thought were claw marks, and then realized there was nothing in Iowa which could claw a horse except a man with a shotgun. That was how his uncle was playing it, keeping score. Loose horses, loose dog bothering cattle, or so he said, stud horse in the fields all winter. The uncle didn't believe in family helping each other out. His stock never strayed, he had no dog, and he never committed a trespass. His bases were always covered, and that was the way he'd always lived. Eldon had wanted to leave the stud horse in his uncle's fields, give it up, let his uncle sell it or shoot it. But his wife had talked him out of it. It wasn't right to leave it there. She also reasoned that the horse might bring what he paid for it, so he would retrieve it, but in his own way. Thus he rode Zipper not through one of the holes in his boundary fence, but up the uncle's drive, knowing he was being watched and judged, like everyone passing their house was watched and judged. He came upon the horses in a wind-protected hollow, his stud a dark spot set apart from Wagner's crowd of roans, reds, buckskins, white-speckled blacks, and a few ponies not much bigger than large dogs. They were nervous, mud-splattered creatures, raising their heads at the first sound of Zipper's hoofs in the sucking mud. Eldon heard their teeth grinding the corn when he drew close. Some of the bigger horses circled the pack and bolted, drawing the crowd with them. They galloped violently through the liquid earth with the smaller horses hurtling the corn rows. The bigger ones never broke stride as their feet struck both hill and depression, wildly throwing mud. The stud, despite its muddy hide, looked satiny and devilish as it fought to the front by nipping and bucking at anything in its way. Soon it challenged